We're not quite sure how it happened, but basically, if any point during the show we mention the lamp, if you'd like to say all hail the lamp, please do so.
We're in our own cult here.
Certainly are.
A legal one.
Don't know what you got yourself in for, Femi. Welcome, everybody, to the Sunday Roast. And we're here once again with two fabulous guests, or actually, one co-host, one guest, and no Max. But we do have a lava lamp to make up for it. Femi, could you please introduce yourself to everyone?
Hi, my name is Femi Nylander. I am a filmmaker, an author, a musician, a poet, and a general kind of artist with a political spin. This is my book, which we'll talk about in relation to migration and the refugee crisis we're going to broach today, I believe, Seeking Refuge 2060. And I did a film a few years back called African Apocalypse on the French colonial invasion of Niger in West Africa, which is available on YouTube.
Very, very good movie. Really, really enjoyed that. Is that the right way to describe that movie? Should you enjoy that movie, Femi?
It's a very well-produced movie. That's what you can
Well,
say.
man. Thanks, co-host.
It should make you think. You should come out of it feeling something. And I also saw another great movie yesterday, Io Capitano, which I would recommend everyone to watch, also about the migrant crisis. I just saw it yesterday. Very, very, very interesting. Very, the same kind of thing. Should you enjoy it, or should you come out of it thinking, I'm glad I watched that?
That's a better term. I'm glad I watched that. Being a historian and everything. We'll come on to being a historian shortly. Big Madge, could you introduce yourself, please?
So I'm co-host for the day. I am not Max Robespierre. I am Big Madge Studios. I run the Big Madge Studios channel on YouTube. So you can search me up there.
Links in the description. I'm Alex, also known as Political X. I am the usual host of the show with Max, but obviously we don't have him, but we have a lava lamp and we have a great co-host and Femi, so that makes up for a lot. We're going to talk about France. Femi, your first topic. You saw what was happening with the refugees trying to get across and the French boats encircling them and pepper spraying them. What are your thoughts on all of that?
This is the interesting thing. When we talk about refugees, we talk about kind of the rhetoric of the small boats. Both France and the UK to a larger degree, of course, don't actually see the majority of traffic, even though they're largely, from a historical perspective, if you look at the relationships, the colonial relationships between European countries and the African continent, for example, I mean, Italy did dabble. It dabbled, didn't do very well, was chased out of Ethiopia, but it dabbled in the colonial adventure. Greece as well, not really. Like France and England were the big daddies on the continent. Portugal had its role, but France and England were the big daddies on the continent. But when you look at the fact that the kind of colonial invasion of Africa, the de-development of Africa, the continued neocolonialism, which I broach in my film African Apocalypse, between states like France and the UK and Africa, and then obviously the conflict and the climate change are pushing people to try and migrate from Africa to Europe. And you look at the states which are forced to bear this burden, and I do put burden in inverted commas. What you have is the Dublin Protocol, and the Dublin Protocol states that whichever country the refugee or migrant first arrives in, they have to stay in. And so they arrive at the ports of Italy and Greece, and the idea within, and this of course it then lends itself to the whole question of peripheral versus core European countries and the power relationship between them themselves. But countries like Italy and Greece bear the brunt of this so-called crisis. And countries like the UK, compared to a country like Italy or Greece, barely are receiving any refugees at their shores in the first place. So this whole scaremongering about the small boats, this small boats, that small boats, this small boats, that feeds itself into the general scaremongering of xenophobia within the British sphere. And that's something which I broach in the book. Obviously you have the refugee from northern Nigeria who's making his way up through the Sahara, but you also have the kid, 15-year-old kid who plays video games all day because he's in a wheelchair, and uses like the VR headsets and like sensor gloves. And because he's very good and has very fine motory processing, what do the Home Office do? They try and recruit him to control drones at the border to stop people getting in. to the country. And obviously, part of that is enforcer robots who are in Calais, and part of their job is to stop people getting across in the lorries and trucks and this, that, and the rest. And there's collusion with the French state for these enforcer robots to be allowed to brutalize people at the border in Calais. And what we're seeing now is that, and this is based in 2016, what we're seeing now is in real time, that is becoming more and more reality. What we're seeing is the British government giving coin to the French state and we saw it with the Calais jungle, etc. But we're seeing more and more and more the French, as long as they receive a bit of cash from the British, actively going out into the waters, encircling these small dinghies full of young, desperate men, putting their lives at further risk, a lot of them unable to swim, risking, I mean, if you encircle these small dinghies in order to kind of pressure them to go back, you're putting the boat at risk of capsizing, spraying people packed together in this small boat with pepper spray. And it plays again to this question of, because this is one of the tensions of the British, that the French aren't doing enough to stop the small boats. So it plays into this, but it's like, if we give them enough money, then they'll do our dirty work for us. And it just goes to show that we have no real understanding in this country. And again, I would recommend everyone who wants to understand the journey, not only to read the book Seeking Refuge 2060, but to also watch a wonderful film that I watched last night called Yo Capitano, which shows the journey that these young men faced. Yo Capitano in Italian, I-O, Capitan, and then the letter O. But yeah, the reality is that it's becoming more and more and more brutal and fascistic. And if you want to stop people coming to the UK, and you want your little white haven of, or even your little British haven, because we know that Brexit Britain doesn't even want Polish people, then what is the way to do that? The way to do that is to stop exploiting other people in other parts of the world, to redress the economic imbalances, which are a legacy of the British colonial and European colonial invasion of other parts of the planet, and to stop supporting conflicts which involve little kids getting their legs blown off and forced into the Sinai Desert, because in a few years' time, of course, there's going to be a load of Palestinian refugees as well. And when you do that, people generally like to stay at home. They like to stay where it's nice and hot, where they have good weather, where then it's not raining every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and where their parents, sisters, mothers, brothers, families, languages, cultures are. They don't generally like to leave their home and try and cross the Sahara Desert and the Mediterranean Sea.
There's almost an element of saying, if you manage to do all of that and get here, God, you've got to have some good character about you. You obviously always have the concern about not knowing who's coming in through the border, and you want to put in as many checks as possible. But at the end of the day, you're going, it's a bit like, imagine, I was thinking about it today, like, you've all read The Odyssey.
It's the Iliad. It's the Odyssey. It's a trek of kind of Grecian proportions. And this is the irony of it. Kind of a 50-year-old pot-bellied man, sat in, kind of gammon man, sat in his on his sofa, going, "Oh, these scoundrels coming here to steal our resources." So the rest, it's like, what have you done to be in this country? You plopped out of your mum in the UK and you're here, right? You exist here. You've not done anything to be here. These people have gone through an odyssey to be here. Who's more deserving? The person who has trekked across the desert, seen his friends die, seen risk dying in the Mediterranean Ocean, or the guy who was born here and who's had all the privileges of being a British citizen his whole life and who has no idea what these people have gone through?
It was something that came across my mind as well. When I was thinking, between the age of 0 to 18, the only tax you're paying is when your parents give you money. And I mean, there's obviously exceptions. There's exceptions to every rule. I try not to paint one brush. But between the age of, let's say, 0 to 16 and mostly 0 to 18, you haven't really contributed anything to the economy. But someone coming over at the age of 18, immediately working, as long as they're legitimate, so they're paying tax, they're instantly contributing. They haven't cost anything to the economy. I think I heard Milton Friedman, US economist under Reagan, actually saying how great it is to have these people coming over. But he also, and it was really sinister and like next level capitalism, he was going, it's really good as well when they just get paid in cash, because then we don't have to support them in any way. We don't have to give them medical facilities. Mm-hmm. We don't have to give them police service and police protection, and we don't have to do anything else, and they have to go into hiding. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the biggest ironies, and I don't know so much about the UK, I've never looked at the stats, but in the US, if you look at the people that come over to the US, A lot of them don't want to be lawbreakers because as soon as they break the law, they'll be deported. So actually, if you look at that as a proportion, and I've never looked at the UK, so that's the only reason I'm not bringing it up. In the US, I found that absolutely fascinating. Like, they've got the stigmatism towards this group of people, and actually they contribute a lot towards tax. They haven't cost anything because if they're over the age of 18, then they've never been a burden on the state. And then on top of that, you've got the fact that they don't want to commit crime. And yet the antithesis that you see in the media and the stereotyping and the language, I mean, this, and Madge, I'm going to bring you in. Suella Braverman's language, I can literally cite where it is in Mein Kampf, the words she used, and David Cameron. You know, I can actually go and show you on this page in Mein Kampf, he goes, migrants are vermin, they're pests. And it's the exact same language. And you have a Holocaust denier go up to her and say, please stop using that language. And she's like, nah, it's absolutely appropriate. I just, it beggars belief. Go on, Madge.
Well, you got to think to yourself, like, if they're not, you know, if you don't have a villain, you know, if we realize, like, what's the actual problem here? It's people in this country aren't paid well. So why is that? And they blame migrants for, like, a lack of resources. They say, oh, it costs this much to house them in hotels. Like, why don't you process the applications? It's like, oh, we don't want to encourage them to come here. It's like, you've catch 22'd yourself then. That's the problem. So, like, in terms of, like, resources, it's the argument of, well, you know, I want to get paid more. Oh, why aren't you paid more? It's because of freedom of movement. That's one of the arguments they use, right? When freedom of movement, I think, only lowered wages by, I think it's like a percentage point or less. That's the main problem we have here. It's just people don't want to accept the fact that it's the state that screwed us. It's the state that screwed us. Yeah. If you look at something like North Sea oil, like, why is that not nationalized? Why don't we have these kind of resources that other countries have done? You could nationalize it. You could refine the oil here. You could actually use it to produce a lot of jobs. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Do you know in Norway how much they... So when they give a contract out for the oil, do you know how much the government own of that contract?
I think it's like 70-odd% or something like that. It's quite high, isn't it?
Close. Femi, any idea?
I don't, but I assume, knowing what I know about the Nordic states, that it was a lot more than a country like the UK or the US would.
50%.
50.
Wow.
And we're offering contracts right now for 17. So state only gets 17% of the total profit, basically, which is nothing. And of course, no one's like, people are moving away from oil, but it just says something about... Just to back up your point, Madge, it says something to just the attitude towards it. That's... Interestingly, I've got friends who are Norwegian, and I was talking to them about it, and they were saying, when in Norway, the way they look at the land, it's sort of for everyone. It's not for a small group. But you look at the UK history, it's completely the opposite. It's like, no, you earned it, so you get the right to have more control. It's almost like a meritocracy that's just gone a bit. Not gone a bit.
It's not even you earned it, though. It's your great granddad. Well, your great 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 granddad was granted it by Henry VIII, right?
Yeah, he kicked a bunch of peasants off the land, and Henry's like, "This is yours, mate."
Well, I mean, look at the monarchy. Like, the reason they're there is because they're good at killing English people. That is literally what William the Conqueror did. He turned up and he killed a load of people, and then his ancestors have inherited the throne. And you're going, "What's the principle there?" And I've said before in the program, there is an old Norse law that says if you want to, you can challenge the monarch to combat.
I fancy your chances against Charles. I do. I fancy your chances. He's not looking too good. He's never looked too good. So I fancy your chances, Alex, if that's what you're saying.
I didn't feel I could do it. I didn't feel I could do it to the Queen. She seems like everyone's grandma. But Charles,
yeah.
I mean, has anyone tweeted that he's had his ears pinned back as well? Realised that the other day. He's had plastic surgery. There's a picture of him.
He's not got anything done about his fingers yet, though.
No, I don't think he ever will. He had those big Champions League ears, you know, the big candles.
We were talking about refugees.
He could hear us. Yeah, sorry.
What do you think the solution is? We've gone way off. What do you think the solution
I think
might
you've
be?
Most refugees stay within the country or within the region. So it'd be about supporting those regions. That would be the key thing. Like Pakistan of saying they can't afford to house as many Afghan refugees as they are, even though we told Afghan refugees to come here and we would give them asylum. But now that's suddenly a problem. So I think the main thing is obviously stop destabilizing regions. That's the first thing. To do stop helping dictators and things like that, open up safe points of entry, that would be another key thing, but also help the countries that are housing refugees now, help those countries, and people won't make the journey as much, you know, give them opportunities within those countries, and that will help a lot, because as I said, Pakistan has expelled a lot of Afghan refugees. Where do you think they're going to go? They're either going to go to a neighboring country or they're going to try and come to Europe. So to avoid that, if we actually help them where they are, it helps a lot more to stop them making the journey here. And safe points of entry obviously make a lot of sense because, you know, for Ukraine, they can apply online. Why can't Afghan refugees do that when we actually promise them refuge? That's a country we have a link with. We told them if the, you know, because we're essentially, we've said, you know, we've allowed the Taliban to come back. It's a case of they could have applied online or via the embassy, or we could have set up a system for them to seek asylum here. We told them to come here. And now that they're here, the only way they can get it is by crossing from France. And now we're demonizing those people, even though I think 90% of the asylum seekers from France have their asylum, have it granted. So clearly the problem is how they get here. And we've made that system of how they get here. We could set up a processing center in France. I know Zoe Gardner was against that and she has reasons for that. But there are other things we could do rather than the system we have
now. Zoe Gardner's against...
Setting up the processing center in France. I think she was saying, like, if it's up to the French to govern it, we won't have any control over how people are treated and such. And if we look at kind of how the French are treating kind of people crossing the channel now, I mean, they're purposely put, you know, zooming past the boats to push water into the boats and causing all sorts of issues. I'm not here to demonize the French, by the way. I'm just saying, like, it's what we paid them to do. So can we really trust? Can we really trust, you know, if the Tories set up a processing centre in France, it wouldn't be set up like that, where it'd be a complete, you know, complete mess. Like, we've seen what they've done here in this country with things like prisons, things like mental asylums, things like that. Like, that, the absolute horror show. So I can see her point. Like, at least if it's here, we can govern it a bit better. Mm. But given what we have here already is not great, I don't know about that.
That was interesting. It's interesting you brought that up as well, because there was a story. There were so many little stories this week. There was the story about the prison guards being able to get in without any checks. I think they're going through a recruitment agency that basically just no CRB, no background check. Just here's a job, go straight in, full security access, and you're like
no DDS.
That came out this week. There were so many little stories along those lines.
I saw that. I saw it was on LBC, wasn't it? I think it was Ferrari or someone like that was interviewing someone from, I think, The Telegraph. And they just got in that easy, light work. They just got into the prison. Anything could happen there. Like, and it does raise the question of who is actually working in these prisons, because they are desperate for prison staff because they won't pay enough. That's the problem. They won't pay prison staff enough because working in prison is dangerous. It's inherently dangerous. And that's one of the problems we run into. We don't pay like government employees enough. And that, you know, you create agency work like that and you allow really unsafe things to happen.
The point you made about the right to work and the fact that refugees often want to work, is and the fact that they're criminalised. The craziest thing is these kind of right-wing pundits who say, well, refugees are all criminals, but at the same time, let's not allow them the right to work as a deterrent. And it's like, okay, so you're saying that they cannot work to deter them from coming to the country, but then you're saying that they're criminals. And it's like, you're forcing them into the illicit economy. You're forcing them to deal weed. Because if you're here as an asylum seeker and you're getting 10 quid of whatever ridiculous, stupid amount of, stupidly low amount of money it is from the government, and you're in a cockroach-infested apartment, what else are you going to do if you have no right to work apart from hustle a bit of green or something in the illicit economy? Because you have no right to work in the legal economy. And so they complain that these people are criminals, but at the same time, they advocate to not allow them the legal right to work. And it's bonkers.
It's bonkers. It is bonkers. And it doesn't seem they're ever satisfied. So what you really come down to is what they actually want, which is just no one turning up.
Yep.
They just want it shut. Mm-hmm. And anything else in any other way is just wrong and unacceptable. But then it comes onto that bigger picture. Who's been feeding them a lot of this stuff? So we need, it's interesting because Labour just came out and said they want to build 300,000 houses a year. Crisis say you need about 400 to 450,000 a year to be built. So even if they did manage to get the 300,000 built, you're not going to get it. But then
it's not Labour building them either. It's the private sector. Labour going to allow more houses to be built on the Greenbelt. It won't be the government pushing like housing targets. It's going to be, they're saying the private sector will do it.
Oh, wow. So they've actually gone that nuanced. That is, yeah, it's so just the private sector. It's not social housing.
Yeah, so it'll be the private sector doing it. Like they won't do social housing. It's going to be, they're going to allow building on the Greenbelt to happen, and they're going to, I don't think they're going to deregulate necessarily, but they're just going to allow more like planning permission to be easier, I think, in order to push through more houses.
So this is an interesting segue, and it was interesting as well because I was going to talk about housing and mental health, it was interesting because Nadine Dorries came out on this morning this week and said, we spend as much money on the prison service, which is 3.2 billion, as we do on mental health, as if that was some sort of justification. But there are only 90,000 people to 100,000 people in the prison system. There are 1.9 million people suffering from mental health. And we've all just quoted how the prison system looks like it's up the creek because the infrastructure hasn't been kept up. No one's looked after it. They haven't built new prisons. Prisoners are now put, generally, from what I've seen and read, instead of a room being for one person, it's now for two, which it wasn't designed for. And you're just going, and then you're making the comparison of 90,000 people to 1.9 million. You're making the comparison of 90,000 prisoners to 1.9 million people needing mental health support. And I know we want to talk about housing as well, to link that in. A lot of the problems that we're having are being caused by the government, and then they're just blaming minorities, the refugees, and anyone that they want to demonize in order to create a culture war. And it goes back to what we were saying about the CIA. We keep pumping information and pointing directions at other people, then no one's going to blame us for our faults. And I thought that was quite an interesting thing, because I mean, it seems to tie in with a lot of the problems that we're having, is that essentially we've had 14 years of total incompetence and really backward ideas, and then a lack of responsibility taking for having made those bad ideas. Femi, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the prison sector in the UK is another question. We know that it disproportionately locks up young black men, disproportionately locks up young men from, for example, a Pakistani or Bangladeshi background as well. It disproportionately criminalizes certain segments of society and puts them behind bars when money could be better spent on youth services, on initiatives, and also just like not criminalizing silly drug offenses that are on drugs that are not actually very harmful, right? So we know that the prison sector is not only kind of economically, it's also morally, ethically, demographically messed up in so many ways. And it ties as well into the migrant detention, because we spoke about migrants, the migrant detention industry as well, places like Yarlswood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of the same issues that you mentioned, kind of guards not being vetted, abuse, which obviously leads to abuse of inmates, et cetera, mirror themselves across both of those scenarios. And I'd say it's more than 14 years of incompetence from my own perspective. But not just incompetence. I think the word incompetence sometimes takes away malicious intent. I can say someone is a buffoon. I could say Boris Johnson is an incompetent buffoon, but that doesn't give justice to the fact that he's also a malicious actor who has it out for certain elements of society, certain minorities, certain groups. I could say Jacob Rees-Mogg is incompetent, but he's malicious. And these people are not just incompetent, they're malicious actors who are happy to criminalize certain groups, are happy to throw them in jail when they don't. And then this goes back as well. There's an interesting book, I think it's called How Schizophrenia Became Black, a Black Disease, or something along those lines. How Schizophrenia Became Black. And then it talks about how in America, schizophrenia originally was a disease for kind of the it's like a kind of, you know, like the whole, oh, my wife is this, that, and the rest, and she's my kind of my wife in middle class America is going through mental issues, and so we're going to put the label schizophrenia on her, and kind of this, that, and the rest of it. It's a disease of kind of middle class white women, and it's not something which has a criminal aspect to it. And then schizophrenia starts to shift in the discourse and become this disease, which is linked to the idea of violent young black men who are schizophrenics. And therefore, the diagnosis of schizophrenia becomes a lot more associated with the idea of criminality. And the way that supposedly schizophrenic patients are treated becomes a lot more linked. I read this book years ago, so sorry for the very, very, very lukewarm, like kind of it. Kind of sorry for the very, very brief and breezy synopsis, but please do go and take a look at the book. And again, so the idea of mental health and the idea of prisons are not just tangentially linked, they're closely linked, because when someone commits a crime, especially a violent crime, one of the main questions which comes up is, are they completely there? Are they sane? Are we talking about something which happened from a mental case, or are we talking about something which happened because this person was entirely malicious? And this is something which itself lends itself to racial disparities. This is something which, when we saw, and I actually knew this person. You remember when the girl stabbed her boyfriend, Lavinia Woodward, the Oxford grad, stabbed her boyfriend?
Yes, I do remember.
I live on a boat in Oxford. One of her other exes used to be another boater who lived near me. I'd met her. I knew who she was. And I saw this thing of girl wow. stabs her boyfriend, and then the judge let her off because he said, well, this is a medical grad with lots of potential, and it would be a shame to put... And then you think about the rhetoric about knife crime in London, given all these kind of young boys who grow up on council estates and who have no opportunities and who are thrown into this world of kind of knives and this, that, and the rest, sometimes carry them because they know other people have them and they might have to retaliate. And you think of the approach to them, and then you think of the approach to the Oxford medical student who's obviously never had any of that, who stabs her boyfriend, who gets let off. And then you start to think about some of the parallels with mental, the ideas of mental issues, the ideas of mental health, and how that language is used. Then it's something which needs to be looked at closely. And it's something I need to do more research on, because I've been deep in the world of migration as I've been writing this book and researching on migration. And sometimes when I do that, I leave other things at the door and don't research them as deeply as I should. But it's definitely an area of concern.
So that's interesting, because I've just been listening to a brain specialist called Dr. Amen, who's based in the United States, and he's been doing interviews, done TED Talks, and he's basically been talking about the structure of the brain and how it can be affected. And one of the things can be trauma. And the other thing that he pointed out is the problems of poverty. And then one of the things that came up from the problems of poverty, is chronic stress, constantly in a stressful situation. So if you're in large levels of poverty, deep levels of poverty, you know, worried about you're living paycheck to paycheck, which a large number of Britons are now living through. That stress from the parents can go onto the kids, but it can also be experienced by the kids. And because your brain is in a constant state of stress of where you're going to get your next meal from, it does affect, I'm trying to use words carefully, it can damage and it will affect the brain. So for example, one of the conversations he was suggesting for ADD and ADHD, because you've gone through stress, chronic stress and trauma, it shuts down certain parts of the brain. And so, for example, when you're in school, you can't concentrate. And that's because you're in a sort of emotional flux, because you're so concerned about what you're experiencing at home. And it stops you from being able to focus on what's taking place within the classroom. Mm-hmm. So you hear a lot of, you know, Stephen Bartlett's what he was told he was useless at school. He's now multimillionaire. He brought about, and it comes back onto housing, he brought up how there was mold, rats, mice in the house. And Dr. Amen claimed that with mold or other toxins, he didn't state many of which, of what they were, he did state that that can also damage the brain, and it can be in there for a substantial amount of time until you do something to get rid of it. He didn't go into too much detail of how you do that. But I was listening to it, and I was just going, if you look at the housing crisis, the social housing crisis that we have, if you look at the poverty that we're going through, social media, I haven't even touched on that, I'm going to leave that, but it is another cause of concern. You're going, no wonder all this stuff is going on. And I'll relay a story and I'll pass it over to you, Madge. There was a clip on that went viral of a young kid stabbing another kid on a train. And there were a group of people sat there who did nothing. And I sort of get why you wouldn't want to intervene. The knife was, I mean, it was huge. It looked like the width of my head, if not bigger. Even listen to like some top martial artists, they say don't ever get involved in a fight, always walk away, because it could take one unlucky, lucky punch and you could be dead. And there's plenty of examples of that in court history. But coming and trying to take someone on with a knife that big, you're going, that's crazy. And you sort of go, is society deliberately ignoring that? are they immune to what's taking place within London? And I've taken that train route. That was another weird thing. That could have been me on that train. I don't know what I would have done if I was in that situation. I literally have no clue because it was such a big knife. There was another situation that happened this week. I was walking to the gym at about 7:30 in the morning, and there's this guy splayed out on the pavement next to a bus stop, and his head is face down. And I'm walking up to him going, that doesn't look like a homeless person. Most homeless people would be curled up, at least blanket, first thing in the morning, under some sort of shelter. This guy's like right face out on the pavement. I came closer. I was like, looks like he's got work clothes. He's got a backpack on. It looks like he's either just coming from work or he's about to go. I looked at his haircut and it was all clean cut. There are 8 people at the bus stop and they're all glued to their phones. And I'm going, what the hell? And I go down to him and I'm like, hey, are you okay? And he's a bit coherent, but incoherent. He doesn't smell of alcohol. He doesn't have that homeless smell. So I'm going, this looks like a guy that could have passed out. And I go, I'm just going to get you some water. Are you okay? He's like, I'm okay. Go off, come back. And I look around and everyone's still glued to their phones. No one's done anything. And I let loose into the crowd. I said, has anyone called an ambulance? Nope. No one's called anything. And I just rip into them, absolutely verbally rip into them, going, what is wrong with you? I use far worse language than that. And it was almost like they took their eyes away from the phone and suddenly twigged what was going on. I don't know how else to explain it. Anyway, the ambulance turned up within about 15 minutes, but it was just shocking to see that level of disconnect. And it goes back to what we were saying with the mental health stuff, the poverty stuff, the social media stuff, the acts of violence that seem to be taking place within London that people have now become so disconnected from, they don't want to get involved. And it was interesting as well, because I'm not going to name too much, but there were students there. I rang up the school of those students and basically they said, a lot of their students have been told not, like, have got it into their head to not get involved because they're so concerned about knife crime. But also a number of them have said that they're concerned about getting involved because if they call up the police, they're concerned they'll end up being the ones getting in trouble, even though they haven't done anything wrong and they tried to do a good deed. It was really shocking. And I promise I'll end, Madge. Sorry, I've gone on a long one. It really blew my mind that people could, like, for all they knew, that guy could have been dead. And they were just sauntering around as if nothing was going on. Like, he might as well have been invisible. I thought that was really interesting to see in terms of what's happening in the UK and essentially a longer term problem that we're going to be building and dealing with in about 10 years because of Tory behaviour. And we can bring in Labour. We can talk about, you know, lack of social housing developed by Labour. Happy to point blame, you know, when I see it, and point good stuff when I see it. Madge, go on, your thoughts.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think with the mould and stuff in the social housing, I think that's a product of allowing a lot of dodgy landlords, buy-to-let mentality of they're going to maximise the amount they can make from the house. Councils have had their budgets cut dramatically, so they can't. The councils are meant to be the ones that enforce stuff on houses where, like, if there's mould in the house that you rent, the councils can enforce change, but because they've cut the budgets of those areas so much, they either don't have the staff to do it or they haven't allocated it. That kind of goes further to social housing as well, social care as well, where the council have cut massive amounts of budgets from childcare. So kids that do have problems, there's no one really looking out for them. Social workers are completely overrun. With the knife crime, like with that story you gave out, it's absolutely wild. That man could have been dead and no one would have known potentially for days, because no one would have bothered to check on him until they saw flies or something. Like, that's wild. But I think in England there is just so much, like, apathy and just no care, like with the knife stuff as well. Like, yeah, it's best not to get involved in that kind of stuff because it's so normalized. It's so normalized. County lines, we know about all this stuff. People know about, like, drug trafficking. It got so bad to the point where people were blaming the drug buyers a year or two ago. They were saying, well, shouldn't we look at the middle class people who are buying the drugs? Because where there's demand, there's supply. And in terms of the knife crime, like, ironically, Jermaine Janus, who's, like, yeah, kind of boring when it comes to football, he did a really good few documentaries. He did a really good few documentaries on knife crime in, I think he's from Nottingham. And there's a kid who had, like, a knife about that long, kind of that wide. I think they call him ZKs, zombie killers. That's the name for it, machetes, that kind of stuff. And he was just, he was like, I carry it around, because if I don't carry it, the next guy will stab me or something like that. And he kind of asked him, what happened to just having a street fight? You just fight and then that's it, you know, worst thing that happens, you get like a black eye or like, you know, a broken orbit or something like that. He goes, no, it's changed. I have to carry this, because if I don't carry it, the next guy's going to stab me. And you see videos of it as well, people try and like, they just attack each other in those random places, like takeaways and stuff. And, you know, just two guys with like knives drawn, so, on each other, and neither guy wants to make a move because they know they could die, so they back out. But if one of them didn't have the knife, the other one's killing them. Like, that's it. And so it's just gotten so bad where the police just haven't enforced anything. They either haven't got the resources, they don't care enough to deal with this kind of stuff, and people become so kind of apathetic. It's just normal. Like, they make jokes about us everywhere around the world, like knife crime's bad in England. Like, that's how bad it is. It's a worldwide known thing.
I wouldn't say all police are like that. I know police.
Not all, but too. I think with the police being so underfunded, like, they have to allocate resources where they can, and I think they either don't have it, or some of them don't want to deal with it. That's the problem.
Yeah, no, I was going to say as well, the point you make about some of the blame being on consumers is that's something which has also been brought up on an international level. When you look at like your coke sniffing banker in the city. It's like, okay, well, do you know what has happening in Colombia? Do you know what has happened in Colombia? Do you know what goes on with the cartels and the amount of violence which exists in Latin America to fund your habit? A lot of them don't. A lot of them don't care, right? But it's always been a question with the consumption of certain drugs, and it's also been a question. I mean, coke is a very different matter, but like with marijuana, for example, it's always been a question of, okay, well, what are you doing? What's the government doing? It's turning this into an illicit product. Marijuana is significantly less harmful to society than tobacco. It doesn't give people lung cancer. Yeah, and alcohol, right? Both of those are legal. Marijuana is not legal, which then forms this illicit market, which then spawns a scene where crime can and will proliferate. And if alcohol was right, if marijuana was legal, then you wouldn't see knife crime around marijuana dealing, would you? And yet you're happy for alcohol to be legal, which causes people kidney failure, and you're happy to, and which causes drunk driving and this, that, and the rest. You're happy for tobacco to be legal.
Have you seen the Tom Holland clip where he talks about alcohol? Because I think he had an alcohol problem a couple of years ago, and he talks about, imagine they made this drug right, which is addictive. It can give you the high, and it give you like really good highs, but really bad lows. And could you imagine, like, they tried to bring that to market, they wouldn't allow it. He goes, so why is alcohol legal? It might be worth throwing in that clip, because the way he explains it, you can tell, I think he had a problem with it. And that's what it is. Like, it's dangerous because people can't control themselves. That's it. That's the reason why certain drugs are banned. Like, at least with weed, like, you know, it doesn't impact productivity that much, despite what people have said about it. In Colorado, like, it's absolutely booming, you know, the amount of money they're making through it being taxed. And that could go back into NHS, back into, you know, mental health services to deal with the byproducts of it, you know, the side effects of it. But it's just madness. Like that one's not hard to deal with.
It's not bodily addictive in the same way as tobacco. So, for example, with tobacco, the argument you just made, a lot of people will say, "Oh, well, you can take the argument of taking tax funds from tobacco and then putting it into anti-tobacco things." But the thing is, tobacco is an addictive drug, and therefore, it's in economic terms, that means that it's inelastic, which means that or price inelastic, meaning if the price goes up, people will still buy it because they need it. Weed isn't like that. If a lot of people, if they smoke weed, and suddenly the price is not. Is higher, they'll stop smoking weed because their body, yes, maybe they have a habit, but their body isn't telling them, you need your next hit, in the same way as it does with both alcohol and tobacco. It's not addictive in the same way. I mean, it is addictive.
It is addictive mentally, but not chemically, is that correct?
Yeah, like physically, yeah, exactly. It's not got that kind of the bodily withdrawal effects that you're sweating. And like with alcohol, if you're an alcoholic, and you don't drink, then you'll feel bodily effects of sweating. Well, anyone knows what alcohol withdrawal is. Tobacco as well, right? You get your high heart rate, you get your this, that, and the rest. Whereas weed can be mentally addictive. You can kind of be mentally addicted to it, but it's not. It's not got those withdrawal effects. That's my understanding.
It can also, I mean, there's cannabis psychosis as well, which is obviously a concern. Which is why, you know, if we were going to go down, it's interesting because I was thinking about this with the refugee crisis in France, one of the ways to get rid of them, and you can see this historically. There was a, I think it was William Pitt the Younger, who had a problem with tea smuggling, So they just reduced the tax, and then the tea smuggling stopped. That was it. And it's interesting, again, like we come onto this sort of business argument. You can see that the government doesn't work on business lines, even though most of them claim they're good at business. They don't think about things economically. So when it comes to the refugees, you've got this element of going, well, if you had points of entry, whether in France or the UK, we can debate on that, it then cuts out their ability to make money, so they stop doing it. I'm not saying it'll cut it out completely, but it should reduce it. And it's the same argument that you could have with cannabis. By legalizing it, you can tax it, which means that you've got more money for mental health. I think you brought up Colorado. I think the mayor or the governor, I think it was governor of Colorado, said he hates marijuana, but he was really happy that it was legalized because they were making so much money, which is just, it's like, wow. I mean,
well, on the refugee side, they're thinking in terms of color. If you asked your kind of average GB News gammon, you could double the UK's GDP tomorrow, but 50% of the UK would be BAME, black minority ethnic. They say, no, let's keep the GDP where it is, because they're not thinking in terms of economics. They're thinking in terms of colour. They're thinking in terms of this mythical idea of a white Britain that managed to colonise the world, but it's not going to have anyone from anywhere else in the world come to British shores.
Do you remember that pub that put up those racist dolls, the Gollywog ones? And then they got all sorts of stink for it and got told to take it down, right? They said, you know, in the end, they moved to Turkey and they were mad at foreigners. And you're like, the irony of this, like the actual irony that you've moved to a foreign country and you're mad about foreigners, or the ones in Spain that get angry because there's too many foreigners. I'm like, dude, like, where do you think you are?
Right. Are you in Britain?
It's honestly wild, like the mentality, like the entitlement. Like that's what we saw kind of in 2016 of, you know, they're not going to stop the proper Europeans. It's literally what a guy said. He lived in Spain. He benefited from freedom of movement. He goes, oh, you know, Brexit screwed me now, even though I voted for it, because I didn't think they'll stop freedom of movement for the proper Europeans. I'm like, there's no hierarchy, dude. Like, not really. Like, what makes you better than someone else who's in an EU member state? It doesn't make sense.
Well, if you look at the history of the EU originally started with some Nordic countries and then a few kind of central kind of core states, and then eventually it expanded to what are called the peripheral countries, Italy, Greece, and this and the rest. And then after that, it expands again and accepts kind of like some of the Eastern European countries, Poland, this and the rest. So this idea of the proper Europeans actually does kind of fall into some British mentality. Some British people will be like, oh, we don't mind Spanish people, we don't mind French people. But when you get to those Poles, or when you get to those Eastern Europeans, and so that itself kind of falls into its own history. When you look at the German fascism, which has its parallels with British fascism, the Slavs, the Eastern Europeans, were seen as lower beings, as this, that, and the rest, and some of that, the whole Brexit thing. Because Brexit, I mean, I know a lot of British people got confused and thought when Brexit happens, we're going to stop all the Browns. But Brexit was like the actual Brexit's about freedom of movement within Europe. So we're talking about different types of white people. And they were still like, we don't want anyone.
I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate, but I'll say that, you know, I could imagine a number of people that voted for Brexit were also thinking, oh, we get money for the NHS, we get money for other areas that we need.
Well, some of them fell for
the EU doesn't seem to be benefiting people. And I'd say, like, there was an example in Wales where there was a group of people, again, old people, outside, I can't remember the name of the town, but they had this statue built by the EU, which was a dragon. They had a community center built, but they were like, we don't want that, we want industry. And it was almost as if they couldn't see the disconnect. It's like, the EU have given you something. Whether you like that or not, they've given you something. The industry problem is nothing to do with the EU. It's to do with how the markets work. You can't necessarily compete with other countries that can produce the product that you want, let's say steel, at a cheaper price in larger quantities. You're never going to be able to do that. So I think there was definitely an element within that where people were convinced of something to be true. And this then comes back to the media being an issue that clearly wasn't, but there was an element of logic to it. Because if they look around their town centre, they're going, oh, the EU's just given us a frigging dragon. What are we meant to do with the dragon? But you're also going, that's not the responsibility of the EU to get industry up and running. That's the UK government who then just...
That was Thatcher and Blair who did that, really. Yeah. Industrialization. Yeah, that was those two who really did that. So, like, yeah, it's just people... Like I said, it's just deflection. People are mad at the wrong groups of people. That's the main problem we have in this country. Like, you can get mad at refugees, mad at migrants and stuff. But is that at the end of the day, is that going to change anything? No, you've got to get mad at the government because they're the ones that cause a lot of the problems. 90% of the problems will be caused by them.
If you look at the genetic difference within humans, it's 0.4%. which means that we probably bottlenecked, anthropologists think that we bottlenecked to about, I think I've read anywhere between 40 and 1,000 people at one stage. So we're all essentially cousins and related to one another. And yet you've got this group that have come up with this crazy notion. It's almost like a religion. It's of thought that makes zero sense when you look at it based on scientific fact.
Is it as high as 0.4%? Because I thought we shared like 98% of our DNA with like chimpanzees. I mean, I might be wrong, but I mean...
No, it's 0.4% differentiation in the genetic structure of humans. Okay. Chimpanzees are 1.4% genetic variation. So that's why we think that we had a bottleneck of 40 to 1,000 people at one stage. We can discuss as to why that happened in another day.
No,
but
it makes
the point
sense.
Is, like, actually, we've got a lot of commonality. Yeah. We haven't got much genetic differentiation. And yet you've got groups of humans thinking they're all superior and that they're all significantly different. And actually, we've got a lot of commonality. We've got more in common than we have in difference.
Again, so if we look within, and this is why you get the whole weird kind of legs it is, because if you look within the EU, and you look at the EU as an institution. So, for example, if you look at the Common Agricultural Policy, there are valid criticisms of the EU when you look at the EU as Europe's relationship with the rest of the world. So you say, okay, look at the Common Agricultural Policy. Look at the fact the EU is happily subsidising its farmers whilst telling developing nations you have to completely go free market, free market, free market. You can't do any kind of protectionist policies, but we'll do protectionist policies. But is Britain more left-wing than the rest of Europe? No. And is Britain... If you when you compare, and this is the thing, you have these relationships with countries like Germany, countries like Britain, countries like France, a lot of the core European countries, the same attitudes they have towards peripheral European countries and Eastern European countries govern the way they think about things like the Eurozone crisis, govern the way they think about the way that Greece was treated after the 2008 financial crisis, this, that, and the rest. And that's why, I mean, for years and years and years, British racism and kind of European racism to the rest of the world has allowed, for example, the structural adjustment loans that basically meant that countries formerly colonized by Europe then had to pay back loans and then interest on those loans, and attached to those loans are conditions of financial privatization, currency liberalization, stuff which is going to ruin your economy, mean you have to gut your healthcare sector, this, that, and the rest. The reason that the same thing, well, part of the reason, a small part of the reason that the same thing was then allowed to just happen to the Greeks was because of the fact that you have this idea that, well, we're British and then, right? So it's weird sometimes to say, and that's of course not an argument for Lexit, because Britain is further to the right than most European countries. So the idea that we're going to leave and suddenly become this haven of progressivism is a joke. But
I feel as if with the under 25 generation, that's going to happen.
Yeah,
I think the Tories have shut down the young conservatives because no one will sign up. There's literally clips of kids in the Tory party turning up and going, "I've got no friends because I vote Tory." And you're going, and Gemma Forte, who's been on, has said she is aware that on the dating apps there are people writing "no Tories."
But this is the thing. The problem is the Tories are kind of slowly becoming UKIP. And with Starmer at the moment, it seems like the Labour is slowly kind of trying to morph itself in some ways closer to the Tories or model itself on some elements of that. And so if the whole UK... But then that's the thing. I do think that the younger generation in general is more disillusioned in general with neoliberal politics, more disillusioned in general with these policies. And any party which then decides they're going to dress up on that and play into xenophobia, play into like support genocide, give neoliberal politics, is going to find itself having a tougher time with the younger generation. I feel like there's definitely a shift to the left amongst young people in the country, not just under 25s, also people of my age group, which is a good thing. I don't know if this is a European wide thing, because I have heard that in France, for example, young people a lot of the time are very far right, but within the UK, I think you have a fair point there.
So within a historical perspective, generally in a recession, people go to the extremes because they're going, "Oh, the main parties aren't working." But I've never seen any numbers higher than 30%, not until the dictator gets in and then starts changing all the laws and making everyone follow them. I think Putin might be the exception because he's done it somewhat subtly. It was quite not going to segue into Putin and how he's done it. But generally, yeah, it's about 30%. So if you've got a decent democratic system, it'll never get higher than that. And therefore, in theory, they shouldn't be able to get into power. Or if they do, they have to have a coalition. So there's a bit of hope, but yeah, generally it has been going up and the youth have been following. So like Marie Le Pen seems to have a youth following. Disturbingly, I also heard in Italy there's a youth growth movement towards the right. Mussolini's tomb still exists and people can visit it.
Sounds like Voulet.
Yeah, he got a gnarly death, to be fair. No dictator wants to die like Mussolini did. That's the big fear a lot of them have. It's like, yeah, mm-hmm. No. With younger people in certain countries turning to the right, is I think Le Pen, these people, it's the populace, the ones that say, oh, you guys do have problems, but these are the reasons you have problems, and they'll normally point out like migrants or something like that. That's the reason they have so much youth support, because when you look at the problems we have in this country, they're similar to other things that they have in other European countries, like probably low youth unemployment, low wages, lack of housing, a lack of opportunities. So if you have someone like Le Pen saying, oh, the reason you can't have houses is because of migrants and stuff like that, that appeals to a certain group of people who won't know better. That's the reason why, like, you know, in this country we've had it for a long time, but with UKIP and stuff, but with younger people, I don't think they buy it in this country as much, because they know that's not true. Like,
it comes back onto that mental health stuff. Are they being encouraged to learn more about empathy and caring for others within the classroom? Has that been a good thing? Has Labour's period of economic stability brought this generation through, which have less issue? Social media is the biggest change. I wonder how much of an effect that's had, but I would have thought social media would have made people less empathetic. Go on,
Well, I mean, look at what's going on right now. Back in Libya, even when what was happening in Libya, with any kind of previous assault, we go back to the Bengal famine. In the time of the Bengal famine, you weren't seeing live streamed images of kids on their deathbed with like their hollow cheeks and this, that, and the rest. Youth today are saying, this is why they're trying to ban TikTok, right? Because they don't control the narrative on it. Youth today are seeing what is happening in real time, and it's very difficult. Like, how many young people watch CNN? How many young people watch BBC? How many young people watch GB News? Right, They're watching their phones. They're seeing a genocide happen in real time at the moment, and so not just that, they're seeing the rest of it. So, and they're also seeing it a couple of years after they were told Ukraine, right? And they're seeing the double standards of what happens when Putin has his invasion, and then what happens when we have our invasion. And so I think, yeah, young people are not buying it largely because of social media and because of the fact that they see in real time the reality.
Magic. Yeah, I was going to say, the other thing TikTok does is, because it's mostly like people doing it, it's not just famous people, it's like the average person. They just put videos up and, you know, they say, oh, you know, I've got all of these problems. And other people say, oh, I've got all these problems as well. They're the same problems. So you realize, oh, it's not you who's a failure. It's a system problem. So I think Grace Blakely spoke quite recently, where it's like people can kind of connect with each other and see, like, it's a system problem rather than an individual problem. Like, if this was like, you know, just before the internet, kind of 10, 15 years ago, if you weren't doing well in life, you might think, oh, I'm a failure. But now when you say, oh, I can't buy a house, my job doesn't pay well, and someone else might say, yeah, you know, I don't make that much money either. You know, I can't buy a house. And you get so many people saying it. It's like, well, it's not just me. Clearly, there's a bigger problem. That's how it goes, because it's very easy to kind of internalize failure when you do it on your own. But whereas when so many other people saying, I have the exact same circumstances, even though, you know, we're both working, you know, 30, 40 hours a week, there's something wrong here.
That's really interesting you brought that up, because I ran the numbers on... So generally in a capitalist society, you have to have an increase in population to support the elderly. You have to. There are a few exceptions to that. I think Holland. But generally, you need to be replacing by about 2.1. So every family needs about 2.1 kids in theory. We're having 1.56, and we're also losing 600,000 people a year because they're emigrating. They're going to Australia, they're going to New Zealand, they're going to the EU, they're going to the US, they're going to Canada. They're leaving. 600,000. If you look back in the 70s, I think it was either 10 or 60,000 a year. So we've 10 times the number leaving. And that was considered a brain drain back then, with just 10% of what we're suffering with now. But if you include the number of the birth rate. The only way economically you can fix that is to have immigration. And we know this because if you go and look at Japan under Abe, when he was in charge, he did a lot of socialist policies, but they didn't, and they increased GDP per person. What they didn't do is fix the economy because it was still shrinking.
Japan has its own kind of hyper-nationalistic history. I mean, you look at World War, Japan has its own current kind of xenophobia where they just want Japanese people. And so they've got this weird rhetoric where they're like, look at all these old people, look at our ridiculously old, aging population. Let's figure a way to get robots to be our carers rather than just let migrants in to look after our old people. It's like, we know you've got great robot companies. We know you're world leaders in robotics, but just let in some brown people and you'll be fine.
All right. I'll finish up on this question. Do you think in Japan they sell more diapers for babies or for seniors?
Fuck it, no. Oops.
Seniors?
You think seniors?
I'll go seniors as well.
Correct. Correct. They sell more diapers to seniors than they do babies.
That's wild. That's wild.
That's a wild fact. On that note, bye everyone.
See you.
See you later.
Hail the lamp. Bye, Max.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Who was it? Who was the famous Labour guy that came out this week?
Mandelson.
Do you know he's connected to Epstein?
Yeah, I've seen the pictures. It's bad. It's bad.
Doesn't surprise me.
Do you know how, I mean, he phoned him up when Epstein was in jail for advice, but we don't know what was said. And he's still in the Labour Party.
Yeah, that's wild.
It's really wild.
Unsurprising somehow.
I mean, when you see the stuff come out with P. Diddy this week, like, it's absolutely nuts.
What happened? Like,
trust me. You don't know.
Well, P. Diddy's been, like, they raided his house because he's linked to all of this kind of, like, trafficking, human trafficking, like, all sorts of dodgy. And the thing is, are they raiding his house to find evidence or are they raiding his house to destroy evidence?
He's the poor guy, right? It's literally Epstein, but it's the music version. Like some of the names that have been listed, some of the stuff that's happened, it's bad. It's bad.
Wow.
Probably
where he ran, right? He left the country.
I'm not sure where he is, but
he ran. Where's he gone?
I mean, he was at the airport and they were talking about him running because obviously with R. Kelly stayed and tried to fight his case and then got locked up, right?
Yeah.
And so what's that Akon song? They locked up, they won't let me out. I think PDD's thinking about that.
We're going to hear that a lot, to be fair.
Where's the no extradition treaty?
he's gone to Mexico, I bet. But yeah, it's bad, Alex. It's real bad. Like,
there's a lot of other people involved who are trying to kind of cover their own tracks.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Epstein, wasn't it? It's the exact same thing that happened where there are a lot of characters involved in it. A lot of people who went to these parties who are like, not me. Mm-hmm. I went there to meet other scientists. I didn't go there for kids, bro. And it's like, doubt.
Is this predominantly in the world of hip hop or is it predominantly in the world of music that names?
Well, I mean, there was a thing where Diddy had a thing with Justin Bieber and then Justin Bieber was like, kind of like, oh, well, I don't really want to hang out with Diddy. And there's this weird clip of like, Diddy being like, you haven't been calling me recently, man. You haven't been answering my calls. And then Bieber's like, yes, I think I don't know if I had your number. And it's kind of like, what's going on here?
It's his label. It's his record label that are the problem. So I don't know if it's like, it could be more music in general, but it's like the amount of power he has is ridiculous. And some of the stuff that's happened there is crazy. I was watching some videos on it yesterday and I was like, wow.
This sounds crazy.
This is crazy. Yeah.
But then this is not shocking because this is what happens when you have a lot of money and power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also this is there. Like, it's kind of like sometimes the rituals and initiations you have to do to get in. I mean, I know people talk, for example, about on the Epstein case, like there's been discussion of, okay, well, was part of this a honey trap? Is it cool? We get people in and then we get compromising information on them and then it can be used for political purposes. I mean, there's been theories about
political candidates being pressured into supporting Israel because there's videos of them on Epstein's Island. And I'm not going to go out and say that to be the case, but there have been theories bandied about it.
Yeah, there's a lot. That, so, like, oh, back to Oxford again. Ghislaine Maxwell was based in Oxford. Apparently, she hung out with Boris, which is not talked about, which is fascinating. I mean, if someone pulls out a picture about her, there's someone claimed, I think it was Boris's sister, claimed she walked down into one of the halls and found Maxwell with her feet up on Boris. But no one talks about this either, which is fascinating. But Maxwell's dad, there's a lot to suggest that he was a Mossad agent. There's a lot to suggest, because I think when he died, he got buried in Israel. I think there were several former prime ministers in attendance, which is really weird, because when he died, he'd been recognized as this utter arsehole who basically stolen everyone's pensions and then used it to like finance himself and his kids, who managed to somehow be allowed to keep the money that obviously was taken from the pension fund and put into their trust funds. It's just absolutely mad. But the fact that he was buried in Israel, I think it was in a sacred site. It was like with former prime ministers. And you were like, why why have they turned up? There was nothing. There was never anything to suggest that he was there, which is why you get this then Mossad suggestion within Maxwell and Epstein, and that there was some sort of connection there.
So if you have a video of a U.S. politician, senior U.S. politician with a 15-year-old girl, it's better than five APACs, isn't it? Sometimes.
Yeah. It is, isn't it? It's true. Like, blackmail's like a great thing. The problem with blackmail and threats is that once you do it, you've lost all trust. And that can then come back to bite you as soon as there's an opportunity to get rid of you, if that makes sense. So if you're the what's the CIA term is handler, if you're the handler of the asset, so from what I've heard from CIA agents, they tend not to do that. However, it's funny that you brought that up with music and the CIA and dodgy spy backgrounds and everything, because I was listening to. Here's a link. Apocalypse Now. The Doors. The Doors lead singer. Fuck, what's his name? His dad was FBI. And there was this whole thing kicking around in the background during the 60s that a number of the music artists were connected to the CIA. And the lead singer of The Doors, his dad was an FBI agent. And people sort of poo-pooed it until it turned out it was the guy who went and got who got a cult of women together and then started killing or trying to kill celebrities.
Charles Manson?
Right, Manson is connected to the FBI, to the CIA. There is a direct connection. Every time he got arrested, he got out of jail like within the next day, and you're like, where have we heard that before, and who has that level of power? It's the CIA every single time. So it's interesting that we've just brought that up with the current music industry, because there's a lot to suggest that the CIA did mess around with that. And we know that they gave
It's a huge industry with huge amounts of money in, so of course the deep state and the government are going to be involved at some level.
Yeah. Yeah, of course they want influence over it, and Cold War, threat of Russia.
Also, it's part of the superstructure of society, right? It's part of the ideological mesh which keeps people away from talking about politics, keeps people away from talking about real issues, because they're too busy talking about the Carters and the Kanyes and the Kardashians. So it's actually intrinsic to distracting the populace from real issues in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's part of the. I mean, we won't talk about it, but it's part of the UFO stuff. There's a claim that's all being done to distract the public from what all secret projects are actually going on within the US military. So it happens time and time again, and it seems that the CIA are. I mean, and I'm going to end on, I will end on this because we should really start, but Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex. Truman tried to shut down the CIA and then reopened it. So he shut down the OSS and then reinstated the CIA because he was concerned about Russia. But Eisenhower, Truman, and JFK were all really concerned about the CIA because they were like, you're literally like a slightly... less, no, I can't even say that. They're like a version of the Gestapo, and it's not me saying that. That's what presidents have said as a concern. that they've created through the CIA, a Gestapo. Which
you
is...
saw that with the Red Scare, didn't you? You know, the McCarthyite stuff. You know, that is what is what they made. Yeah.
So any, we're in the new period of new McCarthyism now, right? The new McCarthy people are getting fired from the jobs here. Well, yeah, fired from the jobs left, right, and center now for opposing genocide. It seems like McCarthyism 2.0.
Yeah, there's a lot, and I think both sides feel like they're experiencing McCarthyism because you've got the right feeling like they're not able to express themselves. Whether or not that's true or not, different matter, but that's what they're saying. And that's what they seem to be feeling. And the left seem to be feeling, if we want to juxtapose it in such simple terms, seem to be feeling and saying the exact same thing. Like, we have been oppressed. We've been oppressed for a long period of time. I think the big difference is that right wing, so like our newspapers and media, generally have been the ones in charge and still in charge and still influencing. Yeah. And no one's going to argue that Murdoch doesn't have like absolute, well, he's now retired, but did have absolute power over what was going on in the UK, and even said that was the reason for Brexit.